Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to the Project 223 podcast. This is Brent, the Bald Eagle, coming at you from a wet and rainy Pacific Northwest. We're here with another episode in our Unsung Heroes series. The Bible says in Luke chapter 19 that the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. In our episode today, we're going to bring to you a man with that same spirit, someone who has saved lots of people in his day. He worked as a search and rescue swimmer for a county sheriff's department and also as a mountain rescue technician climber. He then went on to have a career in the Air Force, where he got out as a lieutenant colonel. He worked as a trauma surgeon in a level one trauma center, where he saw the worst of the worst injuries, things like amputations, gunshot wounds, stabbings, and other life and death situations. The Project 223 is proud to present our interview with medical doctor and surgeon, Dr. Scott. He now has his own practice in the Pacific Northwest area, where he must navigate the rules and regulations of the medical profession while dealing with the increasing challenges of being a patriotic and prepared citizen, an aspiring rancher and homesteader, and an amazing family man. So, without further ado, our interview with Dr. Scott, an unsung hero. Well, Dr. Scott, excited to be with you today. How's things going?
Oh, going great, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to speak with you.
That's awesome. So, yeah, it was so great when I met you. We met at a training class and instantly kind of connected. You know, there's those people in your life that you meet and you're like, hey, we think on the same wavelength. And so that was great. It was at the NC Scout, the podcast host from Radio Contra, teaching his brush beater training classes. We had a good time. That was a fun class, wasn't it?
That was a great, great class. Learned a lot, met a lot of good people, and getting to meet you and talk about a lot of different aspects of life was really a blessing, and I'm glad we've been able to maintain the relationship.
Yes, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get down later in the podcast. So it's great to have you. I'm excited to let the audience meet the man that I met. If you don't mind, maybe tell us a little bit about your background. Where were you? Where are you from? And a little bit about your family life growing up?
Sure. Well, I guess I would say the main theme of my early family life was moving around a bit. My folks liked to move every few years. So, constantly changing schools in parts of the country. Ultimately, most of my upbringing was in the west of the United States. I had a couple brothers and a couple sisters, and interesting side effect of the family moving all around the country is that people come of age to leave home at different times and locations, and so you end up with a family that's more or less scattered across the country.
Oh, yeah, that makes it a little difficult for Christmas and Thanksgiving, huh?
It does.
Oh, well, so then you ended up, did you end up with your parents in the area you're at now in the Pacific Northwest, or?
No. My father had passed over a decade ago, but my mom's in the Midwest currently.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so now you, like we mentioned early on in the introduction, you've made your home in the Pacific Northwest, and that's where I'm at as well. So it's nice to have another like-minded person up in this area. It's kind of seems to be a little challenging with the political climate these days, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I think where each of us live, we are very much a minority.
Yes, I would say that as well. So, some former jobs that you've had as you were growing up. I know that you were part of the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Search and Rescue. Do you mind telling us a little bit about your time doing that?
Yeah, you bet. that was probably the thing that most convinced me to go into medicine. During college, taken an EMT course, and in the course of that, met somebody who went on to become a lifelong friend, and he was a member at the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Search and Rescue, and through that meeting, I eventually joined that unit, and for several years was a deputy with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Search and Rescue as a as an EMT and a diver and a climber.
That's awesome. So you did scuba rescue diving. I guess you would do swift water rescue swimmer as well.
Right.
That's some pretty adventurous stuff there.
It is. There's a lot of rivers around the Salt Lake City area, and so people and cars had a quite a knack for finding their way into them.
Yeah. No, myself, you know, being I was a Navy scuba diver and then with the fire department, a rescue swimmer and swift water rescue technician. So I know what you've been through, and that's some pretty amazing stuff. Did you have any big rescues that you did during your time doing that?
Yeah, you know, sadly, a lot of what we did was body recoveries.
Yep.
We hope it's going to be a rescue, but it was a lot more recoveries than rescues. But yep. There was one. One notable rescue. I was, I think it was my junior year of college. I was taking a final exam, and the pager went off. You know, back in those days, the pager was basically a radio, and so yep. It went off, and you would hear the dispatcher, and so would everybody, within 50 feet of you. And so that went off in the middle of this test, and. Young girl, I was basically a toddler, had fallen into a river at the base of one of the canyons, and that's a very cold water, high flowing river, and it was not that terribly far from the university. And I wasn't quite finished with my exam, but I decided, I may be the closest to this, and this may be one where we can really do something. So
you got the spirit of the sheepdog. You were going to go make that rescue, whatever it took.
Yeah, dropped the test on the way out of the room, and jumped in the blazer and raced across the base of the mountains there to get to the canyon inlet it was. And I was the second diver to arrive. The first one got sent downriver to basically as far as they thought a body might have been able to travel by that point to start working their way back up from there. So as soon as I had the wetsuit and harness and helmet and so forth on, I inserted right where she had gone in, and my dive buddy had shown up from there by then, and basically to belay me from the shore. And within 100 yards or so of where she had gone in, there was a point where a couple huge boulders funneled the river to one narrow, very fast moving rapid. And, I had the long pole that you would use in these situations. And as I approached that, I kind of probed in there, and, in the froth of the white water, I saw a little tiny hand getting battered around.
Wow.
The way the hydraulics were, there was really no way to get to her without just going for a ride.
She was in a strainer, basically, huh?
Yeah, so she was, completely submerged, pinned between these rocks with the whole river going over the top of her.
Well, and that's hugely dangerous for the rescuers as well, because when you get pushed into those, you can't get out. I mean, that's very, very dangerous.
Yeah, and that's more or less what happened. I tossed the pole to the side and, you know, got as close as I could without committing, and then just committed and got slammed into the notch there. And I was able to my head just barely above water, and I was able to reach down and kind of pry her out. And my partner came in from the side and was able to climb over the rocks enough that with one hand I held her up to him, and he grabbed her and took off and left me for dead.
good luck, Doc.
good luck. Self-rescue time. Took off up the hill to where everything just went right on this. They had, you know, hope that they were going to get her, and so had actually called Life Flight out already.
Oh, that's great.
And so literally he runs up this hill to the road, and Life Flight's already there.
It's the medic helicopter for people that don't
right.
know. Yep.
Yeah. And so they immediately start CPR and fly her off. I'm kind of wedged. I realize he's not coming back anytime soon. So, and I've got, you know, this water blasting me in the face. So, I did manage to get myself climbed up over and go down the other side, eventually make it out of there.
Sure.
And what's really neat is that, when they got her to the university, they tried something that, I don't believe it had ever been done before. I think this is sort of the index case where, they use something called ECMO or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation to not only oxygenate and circulate her blood, but, to warm her up.
Wow,
that's always, you know, a problem.
And, she's suffering from hypoxia, but also hypothermia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's, you know, I'm sure her core temperature when she got there was sure. was in the 30s.
But which also saves her life, right, with the cold wet water
exactly.
drowning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it worked, and she not only survived, but aside from what I understand are some minor hearing deficits, she was completely neurologically intact, and
wow.
you know, this is many decades ago now, so she's gone on to lead a very normal life. I think I saw a follow-up magazine article about her some years ago, so
wow.
So that was a great thing,
you know, that as a first responder rescuer, that's what you train for. You go through all the training, you learn all the skills, you stay physically fit and mentally fit for that exact thing. And it's funny because you know, you're on call and you do the job for years and years, and you might, you know, it's very rare that those come where you get that. I mean, she should have been dead. She was underwater for what, an hour, something like that?
I believe it was an hour, maybe a little more. And it was also a record for that reason.
Yeah. And then, but yet you were able to get in there, risk your own life, pull her out, and save her. So that's pretty awesome. Way to go.
That was pretty amazing. The once in a career thing that you hope for.
It's the career save, but there's people like you that are willing to do that, that make things good for a lot of people. So nice job. Well, and so you start, obviously, I'm listening to you talk, people see, can hear that you've got some pretty good medical knowledge. So that you went from being an EMT and being a rescue technician, and then you were went into the medical field, right?
Yeah. So the experience with the search and rescue unit convinced me to go to medical school, and I did so on an Air Force scholarship, Then coming out of medical school, did the 5-year surgical residency training at a military hospital that also served as a level 1 trauma center. So
wow. Awesome.
I was covering trauma call, responding to the trauma room for gunshot wounds, stabbings, car accidents, etc. Every other night for most of 5 years.
Wow.
And then I did some further specialty training elsewhere, and then back to that same medical center as a staff surgeon, continuing to cover trauma call through the for several more years before I left and went into the reserves and private practice.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty impressive stuff. I had a close friend of mine that was recently moved to Florida, Dr. Miller, but he was a trauma surgeon at the hospital that we deliver our patients to at the fire department I work for. So it would be interesting. I'd say, hey, you working tonight? And he'd be like, yeah. And I go, did you get this patient that we just pulled out of this car wreck? And he goes, oh yeah, that was a bad one. So it was pretty interesting to be able to hear. You know, a lot of times we drop them off to you and then we don't hear what ends up happening to them. So it was kind of nice to be able to get some follow-up with him on that once in a while. So, wow. Now, so I imagine that's a lot of adventure and a lot of adrenaline going on when you're doing that job. Did you ever get to the point where it was just kind of like another day at the office, or was it always excitement when you're doing that job?
It fairly quickly, just became, you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
When you've got somebody who, I can remember there was young man who I think he had been stabbed just out of the clavicle, and he came in sitting up talking to us rapidly proceeded to die, despite our cracking his chest, and that's a clavian injury, just extremely difficult to get to quickly.
Sure.
That gets your heart rate up a bit. You gotta maintain your composure and just be methodical about things. But whenever you have a situation like that where somebody's life is in the balance, you feel it.
Oh yeah, you do. No, and that's the one thing I think with people who deal with life and death like that, whether it be a first responder or a trauma surgeon like yourself, you end up having to put a little bit of a hard exterior up, a little bit of a crusty shell to keep from, the emotions from overcoming you. And, as I've shared on the podcast before, I was off the job for about a year due to the COVID mandates, and now recently back on the fire engines working. And, just last shift, having to tell a 12-year-old boy that his mom had just died unexpectedly, you forget how those things affect you. I realized, boy, I got to build those calluses up a little bit more, because it really hit me, having to do that.
Yeah. You definitely have to, sort of dissociate, those feelings to some degree to maintain control. And
otherwise it would just overwhelm. But to be able to do that, my hat's off to you to be, like I say, you're a sheepdog, you're a rescue hero in my book. So I appreciate you being willing to be that kind of a person, that kind of a citizen. So then you did your time in the Air Force, and then now, you are in private practice. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I don't do trauma surgery anymore. Haven't done that in 20 years now. I'm still a busy practicing surgeon. Just much more elective practice.
Sure. And so, like, what are some of the biggest challenges you find in this career? I think people, see the life of a doctor and they say, oh wow, they go to school a little longer, and then they're, making all this money and got the country club, membership. But what are some of the challenges that maybe people don't quite understand as far as trying to do the job that you do, and especially in these modern days and the climate that we're in?
Yeah, it's interesting on the topic of income and so forth. What a lot of people don't consider is that that in the pathway to becoming a surgeon and going into practice and so forth, by the time you hold a job where you're making more than you could earn flipping burgers at McDonald's, you're in your mid 30s.
Oh, geez. Yeah. It costs you a lot to get set up, I guess, huh?
Right. And, you know, if the military didn't pay for your school, you probably got at least a couple $100,000 in debt.
Sure.
So, you can make a pretty decent income. It's not, it's not basketball player money, by any means. It's a good income. You can, live comfortably and, be able to put your kids to the school and that sort of thing. But you're starting off way behind, your peer group that you went to high school with, they've all been working for 15, 17, years, at jobs making far more than you made, as a medical student where you sure. earned nothing or resident where you, very little. So you're starting off way behind with a lot of debts. For instance, one of my business partners, even though in private practice, she was making, good money, I would say she was in her mid to late 40s before she had her student debt paid off.
Wow.
There's a lot of pay back there, and there's a tremendous amount of sacrifice, and it's less so these days. Yeah. Training has changed a lot. I was literally on call almost every other night for 5 years, that meant leaving the house at 4 a.m. and getting home at 10 or 11 o'clock the following night during my residency. It's nothing like that anymore. But you give up a big chunk of your life. And a big chunk of watching your family grow up.
Yeah. No, I think there's definitely a call on somebody's life to do that. And there is quite a bit of discipline and hard work that goes into learning and becoming that, becoming a medical doctor. And then, like you said, it's the long term game. It's discipline, and it's you see some people out there and they do the job for a few years, like I did, and I'm like, I don't like this job anymore, I'm gonna go do another job. And you do another job, and finally, maybe when you're 35, you find something else, something you really like. But you've made that commitment early on, and you've been disciplined and focused and did that. So I think that's pretty cool. It takes a special person to be able to do that.
Long road.
Yep, that's a long road. Yeah, well, and so we'll talk a little bit more about medicine a little bit towards the end, where we have a question and answer from some of our listeners. So that'll be fun. Hey, how about a little bit about your family, if you don't mind? I know that you have a couple daughters. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've got a couple sons and a couple daughters, and one daughter is a special needs child. I guess she's about 30, so I guess she's not really a child anymore. But
she'll always be your child. They're always our child, right?
right. Yeah. She's still at home. We're still taking care of her. She's functionally more or less a toddler. That has a significant impact on lifestyle and that sort of thing.
I guess while we're on that topic, and I know that you're into preparedness, and we've talked about that quite a bit. And like on the Project 223 podcast, just like Proverbs 22:3 says, the wise man sees trouble and prepares, but the fool keeps going and suffers. And I know you're a wise man, and you've seen the value in trying to prepare, whether that be with, learning about communications and food production and self-defense, things of that nature. How does that affect you, having a special needs child, as you consider natural disasters and emergencies and things of that nature? How has that affected you?
Well, basically, in two ways. For one thing, there are certain supplies and equipment and so forth that we need to take care of her. And so, when I try and put back supplies for such eventualities, that there's some special things that we have to store up that you normally wouldn't, special types of nutrition and so forth. So That's something we've had to put a lot of effort into. And then the other thing is mobility. You know, a lot of people, their plan is, there's a big problem of whatever nature is, pick up and go to wherever. That's not really a big option for us. It would be very difficult to, we can take her to the store with us. That's not a big deal.
You're not throwing bug out bags on and moving cross country to escape the biker gang.
Maybe if we had an RV, I think that, I think to have, anything resembling a legitimate bug out strategy, we pretty much have to have an RV and build it around that. We're for better or for worse, we're pretty much taking the Alamo strategy here. So
sure, yeah. And different people have different thoughts on that. Whether to leave an area that they're in that's more of a dangerous area and going to a safer area. Bugging out was people would call that, or making the decision like you have to find a location that you can live that is your bug out location. It's your you don't have another retreat location. Isn't that right as far as the place where you're at now?
That's correct. That's correct.
So that was pretty smart. You saw that, hey, this is a potential problem, and so we're going to prepare ahead of time by being in the location where we want to be, to where we can ride out any of those storms. So that's an interesting way to think about that. I know I have one of my best friends has a daughter who was born around the same time as our son, and we watched as we discovered that she had special needs, and she's just a beautiful, wonderful young lady. But he deals with those same things, and it's been very close to me. So I've seen how that can be a challenge, but also the blessing it is just of who she is and the spirit she has and how much they love her. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on that. People that might have those type of family dynamics in a family situation, they're going to need to ahead of time decide that, hey, this is where do I need to be when stuff hits the fan. So,
right. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. And so how about some of your other children that are doing some interesting things, I hear?
Yeah. So my youngest daughter, is actually in the, Army National Guard, and, we trained as a combat medic.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. She did a great job there, and that's something she really enjoys, and is looking forward to pursuing more training. And so we're really proud of her. And then my sons are, I guess you would say, in the tech industry. One's an engineer, and the other is more involved with marketing and management side of things.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Well, and it's good too. That's neat hearing your daughter, combat medic. I always thought about that. I thought, okay, if I can train my kids, I'll get one to be an auto mechanic, one to be a dentist, one a doctor, and one a lawyer. That'll cover all my... They didn't quite go that way. But that's nice. If stuff does really get spicy, you've got that combat medic in the family. I'm sure she's got a room all set up for her. That's awesome. Well, and I hear she's quite the athlete too. Is she tearing it up as far as in school in there?
Yeah, when she went through basic training, she consistently had the highest Army fitness test score of any of the females, and was just crushing it. And same outcome at combat medic training, which is a very physically intense training. That's a very physically intense job.
Yeah,
I was impressed at the what they put them through and the amount of lifting and dragging and sprinting while dragging and so forth that she had to do. But she's she's not large, you know, she's about medium height and relatively thin build, but very strong and very tough.
Well, it sounds like you're a proud father of all four of your kids. So that's pretty awesome.
Absolutely.
That's great. Absolutely. And so then, and you're married as well. And you and your wife, you guys have a little farm, ranch, homestead. What do you like to call it?
Yeah, that's, we're never quite sure about that. You know, it would be a pretty lousy farm and it's not a really productive ranch either.
But you grow some stuff and you got some animals, right?
Yeah, that's about it. You know, I guess we could try and go for homestead.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's what I call mine. Yeah. And you know what? It's a work in progress, but homestead sounds great. I like it. So we hit on that a little bit as far as what you got there. Is it more fun for you? I know you got some horses and stuff, or are you really focusing on practical things there, like food production? And tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that's been a process. Initially, wife was a big part of the driving force for moving out here, and that had a lot to do with horses. And we have a bunch of horses, and the nice arena and barn and pastures and all that. But over the last 5 or 10 years, we've really worked to try and look at the productivity side of it. Okay, if we needed to produce our own food, you know, how would we do that? So we have done some experimentation. I'll call it that because it's not horribly productive, but we're learning with gardening, as well as we've raised pigs for meat, which has been very good. We have sheep now, and bags and bags of wool, waiting to have something productive done with them.
There you go.
And if things went well this fall, then at some point we'll be having some lamb added to the freezer.
Oh, awesome! Yeah. And I guess that kind of gets to you started talking about that wool. You know, and that's something I've been thinking about too. And a lot of people talk about in preparedness that are, you know, they have a little homestead and they start growing things and having some animals. But is there some kind of a way? And a good friend of mine, Bryce, he runs a training company, Intrepid Tactics, and we've had these discussions about being anti-fragile. So, you know, there's the theory of, you know, somebody can be fragile and so they're delicate, and if anything goes wrong, this, you know, the gas prices go up or the store's out of eggs, they're going hungry or they're not able to get where they need to go. Right. And then there's people that start to become more robust, and so they, you know, they might have some backup, you know, little savings in the bank, and they've got an emergency generator. But you know, if things get really bad, they're still going to eventually have some problems. But being anti-fragile is setting ourselves up so that even when things go bad, we can still thrive in the midst of the troubles and the chaos, you know? And so that's something I kind of think about with our little, you know, homestead, farmstead we're starting. It's like, we got some pigs as well. And I'm like, okay, we're going to sell some of them and keep some of them. But I'm thinking, okay, how much money have I spent in feed, and how, right. And how much on the electric fencing and the shelter that I built for them. And so have you found anything that's making you money in your homesteading stuff? Yeah, like you talked about that wool, it'd be like, okay, is there somewhere that I can, some way that I can sell this to make some money?
Yeah. not yet. You know, my wife's done a little training and got some equipment for spinning, but that really hasn't gone anywhere. And,
sure.
You know, I don't know that would ever really offset the cost of the sheep. And and even with the pigs, unless you butcher your own, you know, you're not really getting anything for free. But you know, we do it to have the capacity to ramp up and to you know, learn the things we don't know.
Exactly.
What works with gardening, what doesn't, yes. What works with the animals, what doesn't. We've got, you know, we've got a dozen or so chickens and, you know, it's great to have those eggs and they're great eggs. None of it is economically productive. And I think if a situation arose where we really had to depend on our ability to grow things here and harvest animals, we would have to have a lot fewer horses repurpose what currently are horse pastures.
Sure. And I was thinking about that. I have some neighbors that have horses as well, and so they enjoy those. But she was just telling me about how they had to put one down, and that was after spending tens of thousands of dollars on medical treatments and things. But I guess one thing I was thinking about, would they in a SHTF type situation, would that be a good transportation option for you, or is that
absolutely, and I, you know. The next step up would probably be if we had cart horses and a good cart. Short of that, the horses are great for getting around. You know, if we needed to go into town, that would be an easy ride. And
sure.
In a dangerous environment, I'd certainly rather be on the horse than on a bike, because not only can you be a lot more aware of what's going on around you on a horse, but those horses are pretty aware of what's going on.
That is a great
point.
Huh.
You know, like one of my horses, if I'm taking him out on a trail ride, if a bird turns its head at 100 yards, he stops.
Wow.
and he stares at it for a while before he'll proceed. So
that's a great point. Yeah, I've often thought about
it. One thing I always said was I would never be ambushed on that horse.
I've often thought about that because people talk about, oh, you know, I'm going to get my bug out bikes and with my panniers, and that way I can, everybody's stuck in their cars and I'm just pedaling along on my bike or even a motorcycle, but. It wouldn't take much for somebody to take a stick through your spokes and send you flying over the handlebars, I've often thought about that. If you're the guy riding the bike down the road with all the gear, you're kind of a sitting duck to get, picked off by people on foot. But being on a horse, not only are you up high and like you mentioned, they're aware, but that horse too is a pretty formidable when you see the police using those for riot control. It's a force to be reckoned with. So. Yeah, well, that's interesting. Well, no, and I appreciate, I think the big thing you said that really is important for people to be aware of and listeners, whether it's radios or firearms training or gardening, you need to learn how to use these things and to do these things when the times are good. Because if you think you're going to have that heirloom seed collection that you got off of Amazon and it's stored away in your garage, and now all of a sudden the stores are looted and you're going to build your garden and feed yourself during the apocalypse. I'm sorry to say, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah. You're going to have a lot of rows that don't produce anything.
There's a lot of trial and error. And we, in our place here, we've got more land than we started doing gardens, and I'm like, it's a lot of work to do gardens in any amount that's going to be, and then you start getting into equipment and tractors and things. And it's like, that stuff costs money and fuel. And so, it's to learn while the times are good, I think is really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and we start talking about, some of these apocalyptic scenarios and stuff. And I know, I think like myself, you're a fan of some preparedness fiction. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
it's our guilty pleasure.
Exactly. I've been a somewhat voracious reader of the genre.
Sure.
Perhaps it's good escapism, but it's also some books more than others, fairly educational, and if nothing else, causes you to think through various scenarios and how you're set up for that, and that can sort of stimulate you to improve your position.
Exactly. You know, not too long ago here, I was honored to be the guest on the Prepping 2.0 podcast with Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher, and we talked about their book series, The 299 Days, and her series is the Great State series. And I mentioned that is that it's kind of like you're going to school for preparedness, because you get these people that have these great imaginations and they think up these scenarios, and it's like, you know, or something like, Austin Chambers, you know, Mount Rainier blows up in the 9.0 earthquake of the Cascadian subduction zone. And it's like, what would happen? And all of a sudden you see somebody play that out and you're like, oh my word, you know, I need to get more prepared in this area, you know?
Right.
What have you read the 299 Days series?
I have. Yeah. That was a really good series. He took a little different approach than a lot of authors have. And I think that, I think that really worked well. Of course the sort of hallmark, author for all of this was, Rawls, John Wesley Rawls.
James Wesley Rawls. Yeah.
Yeah. James Wesley Rawls, Patriots.
Yes.
The Going Home series, by Angry American, is probably my favorite in terms of entertainment as much as everything else. So that, you know, in terms of the series I most enjoyed reading, that was probably the one. There's a lot of humor thrown in there, and that really, you know, helps keep it moving along.
That is a great series. I like that one.
Yeah. Yep. Mark Goodwin's American Exit Strategy, a three-book series. That's also quite good and brings in a lot more of a Christian perspective to it.
Yes.
Then Matt Bracken's Enemies Foreign and Domestic.
Oh yeah.
That's a tough one. Tends to make you pretty unhappy for the days that you're reading it, because it strikes a little close to home in terms of reality.
He wrote that years ago, and you look in the headlines right now, and you think that he copied that out of the headlines.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, wow. Well, he got that pretty much right.
Those are all on our recommended reading list. Every one of those is ones I have. I'm looking at right now on my bookshelf, and yes, I agree with you. You know, not only do you hear, and I like the ones where the author talks about things that they did or things that they didn't do that they wish they would have. James Wesley Rawls was very, very big on that one, talking about their bug out location, retreat location, where they had it all prepared for the, you know, for the long term, you know, living after, you know, the breakdown of society. And in some of these ones, they'll talk about where people made a mistake. You know, I think about in 299 Days, the Todd and Chloe scenario, where, you know, that he was kind of the yuppie that lived in Bellevue, and his wife wouldn't let him have a gun during normal times. But then when the society started breaking down, she chastised him, and he said, well, honey, you wouldn't let me have a gun. She said, you should have been a man and did what you know you should have done. I was like, oh, that's classic. So anyways, yeah, I think they really help you become better, you know, physically and mentally prepared to deal with situations. So yeah, I enjoy some good prepper fiction. We'll put some links in the show notes on our website for some of these great favorite book series from Dr. Scott. So awesome. So in your own preparedness focus in your own life, what are some of the things that you feel like, you know, people have different areas. Some people focus more on radios, and some people food product. What do you think are things that you're really strong on, and then maybe some things that you want to improve on?
Yeah, well, like a lot of men particularly, much of my emphasis has been heavily weighted on the firearms and defense end of things.
Sure.
That probably happens because, aside from being necessary and important, it's also a lot of fun.
A lot of fun, that's right.
you know, especially if you're mechanically oriented and, and just really like working with these things. So, you know, I'm reasonably well supplied there. I've done a fair bit of training. So I would say that, you know, that's definitely a strong suit.
And, sure.
You know, you might argue that I've gone a bit far down that road, but, that, you know, that's definitely something that got on top of fairly early.
I don't know if you can go too far down that road.
Well, that's true. It's like, you know, how many guns is enough guns? It's, you know, it's one more than I have.
That's right. I don't have one in that caliber.
Yeah, that's right. But do I want another caliber? No. So, you know, so that's something I put a lot of effort into. Food storage, learning how to do that. You know, we actually have a freeze dryer, learning how to do that. That's been a great thing.
We got one of those as well.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop for a second. I want to back up a little bit. I'm going to probably edit this a little. So if you don't mind, you mentioned training classes for firearms. Have you taken some professional training in the area of shooting and self-defense firearms?
Yeah. You know, aside from the training I had in the sheriff's office and then the military, I've taken several multi-day courses down at Thunder Ranch, which of course I highly recommend. Great,
Clint.
It's great instruction, and it's a great setup. Pretty amazing setup up in the mountains, and they've just got a wonderful setting for all the things that they do there.
Yeah.
Of course, NC Scouts Scout course was a great experience. Great experience as well.
Oh, nice, Brush Beater. Yep, I haven't taken any of his firearm stuff yet, but that's it's down the road, I think, this year. So that might be fun. So great. And so do you recommend that most people that plan on carrying a firearm and that do carry one and plan on protecting themselves when things get bad, do you recommend that they take training?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's absolutely essential. I think it's just irresponsible to, you know, to carry a firearm without, you know, without having some reasonable degree of training. What that is probably different from person to person. You know, some people grew up handling firearms and some people didn't. But you don't realize how much you could improve or should improve, you know, until you take a course and, see that, you know, you've got a lot to learn. You need a lot more practice, you can always be better. So that's actually, something my wife and I were discussing just the other night, not just with, regarding firearms, but, across the spectrum, let's spend more time and resources on training, whether that be a firearms course or a course to learn how to butcher lambs. Let's not worry so much about stuff. Let's learn everything we can about how to use the stuff.
Exactly. We talk about that a lot here in Project 223 is skills and abilities will trump gear and equipment. So you can make do with a lot less gear, but if you don't have the skills and the knowledge, you're going to be in trouble. It's almost like somebody that says, hey, I'm going to stock up my my emergency appendectomy kit and for the apocalypse, but they never actually learn how to do one. So, is that the right way to say it? Right. Pull your appendix out? Is that how you say it? Appendectomy?
Yeah.
Appendectomy. Yeah. So anyways, okay. Well, cool. Then you were mentioning food storage as well. And you have a freeze dryer. I have a Harvest Right freeze dryer as well. How have you enjoyed that? Is there any favorite foods you like running through there?
Well, the biggest problem with it actually is that just about anything you put in it, when you take it out, it is such an amazing, tasty, crispy snack that not much of it ends up in the storage bag.
You're eating up all your storage foods.
Yeah, you're just, you know, everything that comes out of there, you know, I pulled, I think, 4 or 5 gallon buckets of carrots out of our garden this year.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we froze them, and then my wife used a food processor to, you know, chop them up. And then when we had a chance, we threw them in the freeze dryer. And even that came out as a great, you know, tasty, crispy snack. Crumbled cooked sausage. None of that got it. None of that got into bags. That was just, you know, hand to mouth.
Oh, really? That's awesome. Yeah, I like doing the strawberries. We've actually done different cheeses. We'll chop up little cubes of cheese, sharp cheddars and different things, and those are fun to eat. Yeah, exactly. Well, here's the deal: you save some to eat. We put some in a jar and we snack on those, and then we put the rest, put a little bit in the buckets and the Mylar bags. So, yeah, I really like the Harvest-Rite freeze dryer. It's pretty good. And so then you've been growing stuff in your garden. Do you guys do canning?
We do. I should say my wife does.
Sure.
So she was doing that for some time before we got the freeze dryer. And so, you know, depending what we have, you know, some things get canned, some things get freeze dried, some go in the Mylar, some go in a vacuum bag, et cetera.
Sure. Yeah, does she do just the water bath or the pressure or both?
She does both.
Oh, nice. Yes, my wife's just recently started doing a lot of that, and we talked about that on our episode of for Christmas gifts for 2023 and things to get the American. I forget the name of the one. I'd have to go back and look at my show notes. I forget it already. But there's one of the canners that we recommended on there is a pretty good option. But she's been storing, and it's funny because with the canning stuff too, right? And it doesn't last as long. So we're definitely eating through like things like raspberry jelly, strawberry jelly, and stuff like that. And oh man, it's good. She did from all the tomatoes from our garden. She did her own tomato sauce, and she made salsa, and she'll just pull out a jar of that fresh, you know, that canned sauce from fresh tomatoes out of the garden and making spaghetti or lasagna or whatever. And boy, it's some good stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else on food storage or production for you guys? I think that's a good, everybody needs to be doing that, especially the way things are going. How are the prices in your neck of the woods there? Have your food prices been going up at the grocery store?
Yeah, they definitely have. It's quite noticeable. You know, fortunately we're protected on the egg side of things, but otherwise, yeah, everything's going up. You know, we have a couple good sized freezers, so you know, we're able to use a little more of that and make fewer trips to the grocery store. But I think we've done a pretty good job with that. And this year we did a much bigger garden than we had before, and you know, next year we'll look to do even better.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. We want to encourage our listeners and people out there, as things go, you have your firearms, you have your self-defense ready to go. Food production, energy, as far as being able to be prepared for blackouts and power outages, and your shelter, being able to take care of yourself, heat your home and protect yourself and your family are going to be the big things, I believe, for 2023. So we want to encourage people to focus in those areas. Well, another important part of our preparedness is communications. I know you're a ham radio operator. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's something that I had wanted to do, felt I needed to do, but never had time to do. And when I had shoulder surgery, that gave me an opportunity to sit and read. So,
nice.
I took and passed the tests and got some equipment and got involved with some organizations that have helped me learn how to do things, and then eventually took NC Scouts, RTO, advanced RTO, and so forth courses, and it's something that you're constantly learning.
Yes.
There's always something sitting on the desk by my radio that I need to figure out how to use and work into the system. And just when you think you've kind of got things figured out, then somebody on one of the Mets is doing something different that you have no experience with, and then you're like, oh, I got to figure that out. So it can be time consuming, but to get at least the basic comms really would not be.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You can deep dive as much as you want on ham. So you're a general, so you can reach out on HF. What's the furthest contacts you've made on HF?
Let's see. I guess that would be Australia.
Oh wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that if you want to go a deep dive and if you want to really learn, you can reach out across the world. But even just learning enough to get your GMRS license, or even just your ham technician license that you can use local VHF, UHF repeaters, is not that far out of the realm of doability for most people. So.
Yeah, absolutely. You can really go down the rabbit hole with it, but if somebody wanted to have some basic comms ability, not just locally, but within their region and even beyond that, passing the technician's test is not that hard, does not take that long. The equipment that you would obtain to practice with that is pretty cheap, but you have to practice.
You have
to figure out that this is how I get on the repeater, and I have to have the offset correct, and I have to have the right tone, and it's just a bunch of little things that if you just buy a Baofeng off Amazon and stick it in an ammo can in the closet, when the time comes that you want to communicate, it's not going to be a great time to try and figure it out. So I would very strongly encourage people, even if they're really not that interested in communication, but want to have that baseline capability. You really got to, get the license, get the equipment, figure out how to use it, demonstrate that you can use it, and then you can stick it in a box in the closet.
There you go. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Well said. Well said. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about your location and where you're at and how you can, you're kind of set up for bugging in, and you're not going to be, when stuff starts going bad, you're going to be hunkering down where you're at. But I believe you are kind of in a blue area though, aren't you? You're not in Montana or somewhere where people would consider that a conservative stronghold.
Right, right. Yeah. So if you drew a 5-mile circle around my house, I'd say that'd be pretty darn red. If you drew a 20-mile or 25-mile circle around my house, then you're deep blue.
Yes.
So I'm in a little area where, every weekend it's not a question of whether or not you're going to hear gunfire. It's a question of who's getting at it first and what direction it's coming from and trying to guess what caliber they're using that day. So it's a pretty good area in the small scale, but in the larger scale, not a good place.
Yeah. Well, and I really think that I think in a lot of areas, even where people would consider them, like where I'm at in the Puget Sound area, is considered pretty blue. But then where I'm at, a little further north, in Snohomish County, there's a lot of great people, and there's areas where you can find like-minded people. And so I think it's important for us all to build up relationships, and we talk about that a lot on the podcast, of building a mutual assistance group, building a network of people that you can count on and help out when things are good, and especially even more when things go bad. So, yeah, I guess there is pros and cons to just, you know, leaving the area where you have family or you have a career and a medical practice that you've built up, or, you know, family members. What are your thoughts? Is there anything that, so you already basically told us is that you're not really going anywhere. Do you think that people that live in a blue area should try to get out of those areas and move to red areas, or what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if there's not something that, you know, a tremendous anchor to keep you where you are, such as for us, unlike my upbringing, we've been in one area bringing up our children, and so they're all around here. You know, while it might be great to move to Idaho or Wyoming or something like that, we wouldn't want to move away from family. Yep. So as you said, yeah, we're gonna stay here unless everybody decides to move.
Yes.
But I think if they don't have that concern or constraint, and if their profession or job is something that is portable, then it probably would be a very good idea to move to a red state.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because and there are some red states where some of the bigger cities and some areas are being infiltrated by people from out of state. They leave they leave a state like California or somewhere where they've kind of destroyed the local areas, and they come up here and say, "Oh, this is really nice up here," and so they come to a red area. But then they go, "Well, let's change it to be like it was back home." It's like, right. Maybe there's a reason why things were going downhill where you were. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, we're kind of the same way, and definitely people in our group and the team that I have, we've got our feelers out and we're looking for areas, and we know that we have a pace plan when it comes to the location. We have our primary location where we're at, but we have alternate and contingencies and emergency locations that we can go to get away should there be something that, like, for example, maybe there's a nuclear attack that forces us to leave, or some type of hazmat or a natural disaster like a volcano exploding in the area where you're at, or a major earthquake in it, or, you know, a dirty bomb, something of that nature where you have to leave. So I think it's always good to have multiple options in those. All right. So another thing, and you'd mentioned it earlier, and it's something we talk about a lot on the Project 223, but it's spiritual preparedness. How important is spiritual preparations to you in your life?
Well, that's really become a real focus for me, and you know, I would say that until the recent few years at most, it really wasn't, but that's something that's been of increasing importance to me, and something I'm putting a lot of time and effort into.
Yeah, that's interesting. So your personal faith, you're a Christian man, and have you been that way all your life, or what's your history there?
Yeah.
If you don't mind sharing.
I was raised Catholic. Mother's side of the family was Catholic. Father's side of the family Presbyterian, I believe. Didn't go to Catholic school or anything of that, but, you know, we went to church. My wife and I were married in the Catholic church. As college went on, and then all the years beyond that, I pretty much drifted away, and especially once I went into private practice and became very busy with that, it just ceased to be a significant part of my life. And that's something that both my wife and I have really rekindled in recent years.
Interesting. Yeah, it's we have a lot in common in a lot of ways. And, you know, I was raised Catholic as well. And, but for me at the time when I was in my, you know, my parents separated and went, you know, mom and dad separated, and she stopped him, you know, going to the Catholic Church. And so, you know, I didn't really do that. I was kind of just a lost teenager, just doing my own thing, and, you know, became a Christian through the Ministry of Young Life, and which is a Protestant organization. And so, you know, we started going to church, and I just didn't have the connection, personal connection with God while I was at the Catholic Church. And I will say that I have one of my best friends is a very devout Catholic man, and he is a great man and loves the Lord. And so, you know, I believe that people can, you know, the different faiths, different denominations can still all be, have that personal connection with God. But, me personally, as far as being in the Protestant, we go to a Calvary Chapel church and, really have a great, actually our pastor is also part of our mutual assistance group. So, it's kind of nice to have. Yeah. Yeah. Well then do you, as far as, you know, as your wife, both in your faith, do you have any heroes of the faith that you can think about, people that you, you know, look up to and respect or have been influential in your life, or, that you've been, reading or studying?
Well, you know, of course, I've read through the Bible a couple of times in the last couple of years, and there are, you know, just countless amazing stories and people to look up to there. On the personal side, my grandparents on my father's side were very devout Christians and lived that life and were really a great example, as far as the Christian, living a Christian life, goes.
They lived their faith out, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing the amount of, impact that parents can have on their children. And I don't think we don't realize that. There's been times when I thought, oh, they're not even listening to me. But then all of a sudden later you hear them say something or do something and you realize that, oh, I guess they were listening. So important to be able to impart, wisdom and direction to the next generation. And I think that, you know, you look on whether it's social media, or these different, I try not to go on TikTok, but once in a while somebody will send a link of a video or something, but it just seems like so many of this current generation kind of lack that spiritual grounding, and it's just kind of an anything goes as far as whether it's morality or the way they treat each other, and, you know, kind of a self-centered focus in life. And it's pretty sad to see. And, you know, we talk about all kinds of preparedness, whether it be having enough food or, you know, firearms to protect ourselves. But if we're not ready for eternity, I think we failed in the biggest preparedness of all. Don't you think that?
I agree completely. And, you know, if we could all live our lives over again, we'd certainly do some things differently. And I wish it was something that I had taken to heart much earlier in life. But up for it now.
Well, and you know what I think too is that a lot of the difficult things we go through in our life are the things that cause us to be the people that God wants us to be. And I really believe that He uses challenging things and He uses troubles and trials to refine us. I mean, you think about when, I don't know if you've ever watched a Forged in Fire, or maybe you've done some metallurgy of your own, where you want to temper that blade, and they hammer that steel and they pound it, and then they quench it in they heat it up really hot, and then they quench it in the cold water. And you think about how that strengthens the blade when it comes out and it's strong and it's able to be sharpened. And I kind of think about the troubles and trials that we go through in life, because I often say that myself. It's like, oh Lord, you know, why didn't I earlier do this or that? Or why did I do those things that I shouldn't have done, or not do these things I should have done? And I've kind of felt Him tell me that, you know, those are some of the things that have made you the person that you are, and those are the way I taught you some really difficult lessons. And so what do you think about that?
No, I think that's an excellent perspective, and I think you're right. There's certainly many examples in the Bible where good people have done some bad things and bad people turn around and do good things. And
David, so, Samson, Abraham, the list goes on. Peter.
There's brokenness throughout the Bible. And
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's awesome. But on a little side note, I was just thinking about it. Have you seen the show The Chosen? Have you watched that?
That sounds familiar, but I can't place it.
I would encourage you and anybody listening. It's called The Chosen, and it's a series. It's like a TV series starting about the life of Jesus, and it starts off, early on when Jesus is first picking up his, and it's on season 3 right now. And it's a great, you can get it for free. They have an app that you go on to and you can watch the episodes, screencast it right off your phone, or you can actually get them on YouTube. But all the episodes are free. It's a crowdfunded project. And this recent season. So yeah, I'd encourage you to check that out. We'll put a link to that on the website as well. So that's a pretty fun show. So. Well, if you don't mind, I would like to get into a few questions from some of our listeners and some friends of mine. Would you be up to hit on a few questions?
You bet.
Great. And so some of these questions are from these guys are, I've got some questions from a Green Beret, some 25-year paramedics, firefighter EMTs, and other people. So they've got some interesting questions, and that's kind of the mindset that's behind them all. So, we'll see what you got for them. And, so first off, they kind of fell into a couple different categories. And the one was questions that people wanted to ask a Patriot medical doctor regarding the medical field post COVID. So we all have been through a lot in the last few years, and it's, kind of changed the way a lot of people interact with the medical community. So some of the questions, and these are kind of interesting, and I'm kind of reading them for what they said, and you can answer how you want, but I guess there's some people that are having a little doubt in their trust about the medical system and wanting to know where they can find trusted sources of information regarding things in the medical community. What are your thoughts on maybe people that have kind of lost some of their trust and getting mixed messages, post-COVID?
Yeah, that's very understandable. I think that there has been a lot of trust. So even from my perspective, when hydroxychloroquine was first thrown out there as a treatment, the official narrative was that this was the most dangerous drug on the planet and had to be administered in an ICU, and so you should never self-administer that. Anybody who had been in the military, at least in decades past, knows that this stuff's handed out like candy to anybody deploying to an area where malaria is endemic. It's an incredibly widespread, very, very safe medication. So it was like, that doesn't sound right. And then on with ivermectin, about how it's, this dangerous horse drug that you would never give to a person, whereas the World Health Organization had previously declared it, one of the most important medications for humans that had come along. So, I think credibility has definitely taken a hit. One of the jokes about surgeons specifically in the past was that, well, if you had a panel of 5 surgeons and you asked them the best way to fix a certain condition, you'd probably get 7 answers. through the COVID thing, you really didn't hear a lot of dissent. And what you did hear got stomped on quite a bit. So I think, I can see where a lot of people have lost a lot of trust. The whole it's silly to wear a mask. You don't need to wear a mask. There is no reason. Don't go buy a mask. You don't need to wear a mask. And then the next day, it's like, oh, you all have to wear a mask all the time, especially when you're in the car by yourself.
Riding a bike down the sidewalk.
right. Exactly.
I saw somebody on a paddleboard. I saw somebody on a paddleboard on a lake one time wearing a mask. So,
yeah, Yeah. And I think, you know, people, a lot of people probably very much got the sense that politics were, you know, policy was driving the medical narrative rather than the medical narrative driving policy.
Sure.
And, you know, how much was true and how much was not, you know, hard to say. I'm not a virologist. That's, you know, the whole COVID thing had a tremendous impact on my practice, mainly because it shut down the elective procedures made people, you know, afraid to venture from their homes and get medical care. So
this is terrible.
So it had a tremendous impact on us, but, you know, not at any point, during the entire, you know, 2-3 years, did I ever take care of somebody that was sick with COVID? You know, I had lots of patients procedures canceled the day beforehand because they, you know, their asymptomatic COVID test came back positive, but was never involved in the care of anybody who was actually sick with COVID. So, you know, it's not like every bed in the hospital was full of somebody dying of COVID. There was a lot more people dying with COVID rather than of COVID. But, I can certainly sympathize with the idea that a lot of trust has been lost, and some of my trust has been lost. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, in terms of advice to people, I think, you know, the trust is probably best found on a, you know, person-to-person basis, you know, to find a physician that you have trust in, and, you know, trust them to synthesize you know, the truth out of what information is publicly available to them.
Almost like find the person you trust first, and then get the medical advice from them, rather than just taking medical advice from somebody where you don't necessarily know that person's viewpoint or outlook on things, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right. You know, I think there's been a tremendous amount of disinformation or misinformation on both sides of the debate. So it is, it does become difficult to know what you can trust.
Well, and I do realize, being, you know, being an EMT myself, that, you know, for doctors, they do call it practicing medicine. So, you know, I'd have to say that.
You're right. And
there's some medics and there's some EMTs that are really good. I'd love to have them working on me. And then there's others I would say, stay away.
and in most areas of practice, there is a lot of variability between how different doctors would manage a given situation or treat a given patient. Uh-huh. And that's all within the realm of acceptability and normal, and where there is not absolutely clear evidence that this way of doing it is the best way. And there are areas where those guidelines are based on good evidence and seem to be right. And if when that is the case, then, you know, you should follow those guidelines. But there's a lot of areas where it's not until, you know, we think this is the best way to do it, but we're not so sure about that. And, you know, a lot of medicine is say, well, this isn't working. Let's try that.
Sure. Yeah. And I know it might be a little difficult to talk about, but do you feel like that some of the way that you treated patients had to change a little bit, or was there some peer pressure on you, or did you stand up at any time against some of those things that were there, or were you able to, how did you navigate that?
You know, like I said, I was never really involved in the care of any COVID patients.
Sure. You weren't making decisions to put people on respirators or give them
remdesivir
exactly.
Right. You know, I'd have friends and so forth ask, you know, what do you think about this, and I'd tell them what I thought, and you know. you know, prefaced by, you know, a lack of experience and lack of clear evidence on which way, you know, which way to go is best. There's certainly a lot of pressure to, you know, to follow the narrative and the guidelines as they are. I think the medical boards have been pretty quick, to, you know, take licenses from people who say, okay, this is silly. We're not wearing masks in my clinic. Has proved to be a very quick ticket to losing your medical license.
Yeah, it's
or, you know, speaking up and saying, you know, don't do this and take this other thing that the government doesn't want you to take. It has been a bit surprising how little, you know, healthy debate was allowed. It's pretty much, this is the plan and you will stick with that. Yeah.
And, you know, and we could, that's a whole another rabbit hole of talking about the whole pandemic and the responses there. And we've talked about that before on the podcast, and we're not going to necessarily deep dive on that whole thing. But yeah, it's been a challenging thing, and I am, you know, I can understand. I'm sorry that you and your practice had to deal with some challenging times because of that as well. But yeah, I appreciate your insights there. So let's move on a little bit. This was the next kind of topic. Was that a lot of people wanted to know about some preparedness medicine information and things like maybe what would be like a list of important medications for preppers in a grid down, no electricity scenario. So like what kind of meds can be used, what different meds they can be used for, the best storage method. Do you have any things like in your own particular medical bag that you're like, hey, these are the things that I want, or maybe is there a top three or five that you would say, hey, these would be good ones to have?
Yeah, well, the first comment I'll make is that along with the firearms being the, you know, the easy fun thing to do, the irony here is that because medicine is my career, it was initially the least interesting part of any of this, and probably where I am farthest behind in preparation.
I don't need. Yeah, I don't want to store up a big medical kit. I do that for
work. Yeah, you know. So that's something that I've actually only as of the last, you know, 2-3 years started to think, I really don't have that much here, and have started to work on that. You know, in terms of medications, certainly if somebody is on a medication that they require, a heart medication or something.
Your specific prescription meds, huh?
Yeah, anything you can do to, you know, to start putting that back, you know, refill early, building up a supply of that would be certainly advisable.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I would strongly recommend that everybody have a good supply of antidiarrheals at their home.
Sure.
In countless wars, more people have died of, you know, diarrheal illnesses than bullet wounds. If you go back in history.
Sure.
So when things aren't normal, people end up eating or drinking things that aren't optimal, and they end up with diarrhea, and that can be life threatening. So
whether it's a squirrel or some nasty water, right?
Right. So I would have a good supply of antidiarrheals. That would probably be the number one thing.
Sure.
Antibiotics. In terms of what situation could arise where having or not having a medication would make a huge difference. For skin infections, things you could obtain from even just minor injuries that, you know, in the modern world are generally pretty easy to treat, but in the absence of antibiotics could become, you know, a potentially life or limb threatening problem. That would probably be it. But beyond that, I think it would just be a matter of
your basic first aid stuff.
Yeah.
Benadryl and things of that nature, and Neosporin and others,
right.
First aid types.
And there's actually a book. What is it? I think it's the Prepper's Medical Handbook by William Forgy. It's got a pretty good list of what exactly he would recommend.
Oh, okay, great. Great. Well, we'll get a link to that also on the under the podcast notes on our website. So, Prepper's Medical Handbook by William. What was his last name?
I think it's Forgey.
Okay. Well, we'll get that. I'll figure that out, and we'll put a link up for our listeners. So, great. I appreciate that. Okay. So that's some medical manuals, books. Any other sources of information to have on hand for, whether the Merck manual or wilderness medicine. Guides or anything like that?
Yeah, there's another handbook, Survival Medicine Handbook by Alton and Alton, A-L-T-O-N. It's a husband and wife. One's a physician. The other is, I think, a nurse practitioner. And they've a lot of good information.
Okay, perfect. We'll put that one up as well. So, yeah, that would be one of those things where... if you don't have access to a doctor, and probably a good idea to if you're building your mutual assistance group and network, find a good doctor in your neighborhood that you can make friends with, invite him over to the barbecue, and get him on your team. Wouldn't you say that'd be a good idea?
That would be a very good idea, and you probably want to find an ER physician or a. Or a family medicine doctor would probably be a very useful folks. Another source that comes to mind, there's a book out there called When There Is No Doctor, or something very close
sure,
to that.
Sure, yep.
And then another one, Where There Is No Dentist. And I think
I've heard of those, yep.
Here somewhere.
yep.
But because I don't know much about dentistry, so.
Yes. Yep.
That would be a very good idea because teeth are important.
Exactly. How about things during a grid down? Any thoughts on like bone setting? Or I had one friend talk about maggot debridement or using honey or sugar wound care. I mean, now we're starting to get into some alternative medicines. Any thoughts there? I know those are kind of some big topics, and it'd be hard to go deep into those, but imagine some of those books would have information on there. And
yeah, I would probably get the books, flip through them, know what's there and where it's at. And if some situation comes up where you're stuck with that, then go read it a little more thoroughly. But I don't think those are things. There's just such a broad range of
exactly as far as alternative treatments. Yeah, you don't know until you're faced with something. But
the idea is so many things that a lot of what you read in the Prepper books on the medical side is kind of silly. From the perspective of a surgeon, in the absence of anesthesia. Not terribly useful. There's a lot I can do with anesthesia, not so much without it. Mostly would be able to take care of minor wound issues, that sort of thing. So you got to be realistic. So I wouldn't go overboard on thinking of all these things you're going to do. There is a course Partisan Lifesaver course.
Yeah, Stuck Pig Medical.
Yeah,
Medic.
That would probably be a very good, overview sort of thing to take. But I wouldn't go too far down the rabbit hole of, trying to figure out how to set fractures and so forth, because you're just you're not going to get the knowledge or experience. And if you find yourself stuck in that situation, then pull out the book. And
you're going to be winging it. That's right. Or go join a fire department and see if they send you to paramedic school and to pay for that
there
for you.
There you go. There you go.
I was just recently reading a book, Black Autumn, and it's a really interesting series. And they had a prepper community that they had kind of put together. And this guy saw forward ahead to the troubled times that were coming and prepared and built this network of people. And they could kind of buy into this community, not physically pay to buy in, but they could be a part of the community. And he gathered, you know, medical, he had some nurses and doctors there. And sure enough, you know, things went downhill and there was a collapse and they took casualties during a battle to protect their community. And it was really interesting because the doctors and nurses there, what would happen is all of a sudden some of these enemy combatants, and these guys were, you know, people that were trying to kill them and, you know, kill the people and take all their food and, you know, rape their women. And yet some of the wounded on the enemy side got brought into the clinic and the nurses and doctors started to treat them. And the former special forces army guy came in and was like, "We're not wasting our equipment and our treatment on these," and he, you know, pulled the enemies out there and wouldn't let them. And there was this conflict back and forth. And I know it's the Hippocratic Oath, right? Is that's the do no harm. But what do you think? Is that, I know this is kind of be controversial too, but could you, if you got into a thing where it was a life or death and without rule of law, do the rules for a doctor change in the collapse? What do you think, Doc?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certainly the issue of triage and, you know, what, you know, where you could draw the line.
How much resources do you have, right? Yeah.
Right, right. You know, I would say in that circumstance, that's a decision that is not a medical decision. That is a community decision that gets made and enforced before they get to the medical tent.
At a political level, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If they get to the medical tent, you know, the physicians and nurses and so forth are going to do what they're trained to do and take care of people. So at that point, they're not, you know, on some level, they're just a person.
Yeah,
you know, and
exactly.
Take care of them. So if it is to be the policy not to provide medical care to the enemy wounded, then don't take them to the medical center.
There, that's a great point. I appreciate that. yeah. If you don't want them treated, then I don't want to see them.
Right.
A great point. Well, I know it's interesting because those are actual things to think about. I remember going on my first call where there was, it was a scene of violence and there was two or three victims. And I went over to one of the victims that was bloody and I started to work on this person. And I'm not going to say gender at all, but I started to work on this person. And the cop was like, "Hey, what are you doing helping that person out? Help this one out. That's the perpetrator. This one's the victim." And I was like, "Oh, interesting." You know, I was just trying to help the first one I saw that seemed like they needed the most help. It, without really realizing, and you know, that doesn't, obviously in my career, I don't pick or choose or discriminate based on anything. I treat the patient based on our protocols. But it was an interesting thing to think about, you know. so now when I do go to a scene like that, I definitely ask them, which one's the victim here? And if all things are equal in severity, right, the victim is going to get my attention first.
That makes good sense.
Yeah. One of the questions somebody said, it was about quarantine during a without rule of law or breakdown in society. Are there things you can do to set up some type of quarantine with things like tuberculosis or different diseases? And what would you do in that situation, Doc?
Well, that's, you know, I think it's just basically a matter of physical isolation, you know, whether you put somebody out in a tent somewhere or, you know, some part of the house where the air is not being circulated, Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that. You know, interestingly enough, there's it seems like there's a fair bit about that in the Bible in terms of the management of lepers and so forth.
Oh yeah, had to stay outside the city. And,
mm-hmm. Right, and what the tests and so forth were to be clean and be allowed back and so forth. So there may be some value in that, but. Yeah, and infection control and things like quarantine will be a real problem because, you know, if average people are having to make these decisions, then there's probably no tests to decide who to quarantine. So it's a tough situation.
Yes, it is. Another question, boy. I tell you, we got some creative people out there that are thinking about the worst case scenarios here. But one question was, and I'm just going to read the question verbatim. What's the best method to dispose of dead bodies, especially morbidly obese bodies that are too heavy to lift or move?
Oh, that's
I thought that was pretty good. Have you read the 100 Deadly Skills books by Clint Emerson?
I think I have one such book on my shelf that I kind of flipped through, but I haven't actually read it.
They're actually pretty interesting books. In his original one, he has a section on how to dispose of a body, and he hit on three ways. Was his ways were land, thermal, or maritime, and so you can translate that to burying them, or burning them, or dumping them at sea. So I thought that was a pretty interesting thing, but it's a good question. I mean, during like a real pandemic where there's hundreds of thousands of people dying and services are down. I know, it's real easy for us. We have a dead body and the police officer stays with the body and the medical examiner comes and picks them up and, they take care of it. But what are your thoughts as far as how things will go? Should things get really bad like that? And there's a lot of death around in the community.
Yeah. In the cities, I can't imagine, how that would work out, if it was to the point of, societal breakdown and a very high fatality rate. Further out, a great thing to have a backhoe or an excavator.
Yeah, there you go. Truth and some lime, some bags of lime. And
Right. You have to have that book and look up exactly how to manage that.
That's a pretty good. I'd encourage you if you don't have that. It's a really interesting chapter to read. So I thought that was it was pretty good. So I'm surprised he got away with with publishing that book. But in Minecraft, right? In Minecraft, how do you dispose of them? Well, Doc, it's been great talking to you, and I really appreciate the information you've shared. I appreciate you and the heart that you have, number one, to, heart of a rescuer, saving a little girl's life as a young man, saving many lives. I can guarantee as a trauma surgeon over the years, I know that those guys do, you and my friend James also do just great work. I mean, things that, very small percentage of people in the world have the skills to be able to save people's lives that are even just a close friend of ours is a guy on our team was recently in a car accident and, could have easily just been killed if it wasn't for an amazing trauma surgeon that helped rebuild his arm and his leg that were destroyed. So I appreciate the fact that you've done that. And then now to serving your community as a doctor, serving your family, taking care of your daughter who has special needs, and you're just this faithful man who is takes care of her, takes care of your wife, and is seeking out the spiritual preparations of worshiping his God and just being a prepared citizen in that way. So I just it's great to know you, and I'm excited to continue to be your friend. And so do you have any final things you'd like to share as we wrap up the podcast for today?
Well, I'd really like to thank you for inviting me. This has been a wonderful experience, and it's always great to talk to you. And I'm glad we had the time to do this. It really impressed me when I first met you. You were somebody who really took everybody's interest into consideration, and you're constantly a source of good information and thoughts. And we'd be sitting around having a bite to eat, and it's like, okay, what do you have in your vehicles for to deal with a fire or this emergency or that situation? Always kept people thinking, and I learned a lot from that, and I appreciate the attitude you have towards that and how outgoing you are about that. And I'm really excited to see that has led you to doing your podcast. I think that's a wonderful service to the community. And God bless America. And thank you.
God bless America, and God bless you, my friend. It's been great talking to you. Well, and there you have it, folks. That's a wrap on another inspiring episode in our Unsung Heroes series, where we like to shine the spotlight on everyday Americans who have done extraordinary things, but don't seek out the attention or the fame. I hope you enjoyed our chat with Dr. Scott as much as I did. Remember, anyone can do great things when you step out in courage and serve your family, your neighborhood, and your community. We can all make a difference, and that's what makes this nation great. So, signing off from the Eagle's Nest, once again, the Bald Eagle. Out.
Thank you very much.